Okay, then I will call our second case of the day, Lopez Quintero versus Michael D.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Wirchow. Seated at council table is law student Victor Velaez. We are with the Frank J. Remington Center at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We represent the petitioner, Ezequiel Lopez Quintero. Mr. Lopez Quintero's case requires this court to address issues at the intersection of equity, finality, and efficiency, and the great writ of habeas corpus, the highest safeguard of liberty. The Court of Appeals decision in Smalley versus Morgan reduces the great writ of habeas corpus to a static, narrow, formalistic remedy that strips equity. The Smalley decision interpreting Section 809.51, imposing a prompt and speedy requirement on night petitioners, is objectively wrong for three reasons. The first reason is that in seeking to expedite the resolution of habeas petitions, Smalley ignores the equitable heritage of habeas corpus and the vital role that the Great Writ plays in protecting constitutional rights.
Counsel, yes. Would you say that latches is a legitimate defense for the state to assert against a habeas petition?
I would say that latches defense has constitutional problems with it, the same as Section 809.51.
How can it have a constitutional problem when the writ of habeas corpus is of a common law origin?
It is of a common law origin, Your Honor, but the common law traditionally did not impose a bar on habeas petitions for untimeliness.
Well, that might be tradition, but is that constitutional?
Well, the constitutional problem, I think, comes in because an entire judicial proceeding is deprived of the petitioner simply because he's been unconstitutionally abandoned by counsel. And that's where the problem comes in. But the habeas and equity are part of habeas even in the common law, but even now under statute, under the federal rules governing habeas provisions, the statute, previous statute, habeas rule 9A, still didn't allow the dismissal of habeas petitions for lengthy delay alone.
Did the statute say anything about timing?
The statute, the habeas rule 9A?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, it does talk about that a delayed petition, if it's there's a particularized showing by the state of prejudice and that prejudice is directly related to the unreasonable delay,
okay,
then the court may.
Yeah, and then that evolved into the one-year statute of limitations. Right?
That's correct.
And then there was, because the courts understood the statute as not having abrogated their equitable authority, they applied equitable tolling to the one-year statute of limitations, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Is there anything unconstitutional or infirm about that setup for the federal courts?
There is not. And the reason there's not, Your Honor, is because in Holland versus Florida, the United States Supreme Court did find equitable tolling in what appeared to be a very strict one-year statute of limitations under the AEDPA.
Okay.
And the reason the court...
And who has the obligation of establishing equitable tolling?
The petitioner has the obligation. And in that, what the court has said, the Supreme Court of the United States has said, is that the petitioner can show an extraordinary circumstance, which can include abandonment by counsel. So there is an opportunity there for the petitioner to get out from under that strict statute of limitations.
Okay,
but
so,
so
putting a time element into a writ of habeas corpus is not unconstitutional and it's not unknown to our law, correct?
Well, the difference in the federal side of the ledger is that the petitioner has already gone through the state post-conviction process. In Mr. Lopez-Quintero's case, he didn't go through the state post-conviction process. He didn't have a direct appeal.
Well, and the reason the one-year statute of limitations applies regardless, right? If you bring a federal habeas petition, you've got 1 year to do it.
That's correct,
Your Honor. Okay. And if that, if circumstances warrant equitable tolling of that 1 year, the petitioner can make that argument. Yeah? Okay. So, and that's a yes?
Yes.
Okay. So, so at least at the federal level, putting a time bar on the writ of habeas corpus is not constitutionally or equitably infirm, correct?
It is not, but the court was very specific in saying we are going to find, number one, that the statute of limitations is not jurisdictional. It's an affirmative defense that has to be raised by the state. And the court also said it's not inflexible. We don't try and stop delay at all costs. And the reason the court did that is for two reasons. The very principles of habeas corpus, that is, the great writ protecting constitutional rights. The court didn't lose sight of that. And secondly, the court said that it will not construe a statute to displace our traditional equitable authority absent the clearest command. Section 809.51 does not have that clearest command whatsoever.
Yeah, so let's say that's true, and we're just looking at whether latches could be applied. So if it's not constitutionally or equitably infirm for the federal courts to impose a time limitation on the writ, then how could it be constitutionally or equitably infirm for us to allow latches to supply a time limitation on the writ?
I think the difference has to be that on the federal side, that the petitioner has gone through possibly the state court review system. But the difference here is that Mr. Lopez-Quintero didn't even have that opportunity, didn't have the direct appeal. And it is counsel's abandonment, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, who abandoned him, that caused him to be to extinguish his appeal rights. That's not the case with the ADPA. The only thing that's going to be extinguished is not the constitutional right to direct appeal or post-conviction. I'm sorry, not post-conviction, but direct appeal. That right is not being extinguished. It's the right to have federal review of your sentence.
So you bring habeas because you want to have an appeal. Is it the appeal from the decision on the suppression motion?
Can you repeat that?
It is. Yeah, you're bringing habeas for a reason. You want to reinstate appeal rights.
That's correct.
Okay. And what you want to appeal, I assume, is the decision on the suppression motion, correct? When Mrs. Henning's house was searched and items were found belonging to Mr. Lopez-Quintero, and the trial court ruled against you when a motion, not against you, but against the position of Mr. Lopez-Quintero when a suppression motion was made, is that the issue that you want to appeal?
No, Your Honor. That was the issue in the Coleman versus McClatchy case. In our case, we don't know what issues Mr. Lopez
Well, then how can the state respond to your habeas? I mean, one of the arguments you make to us is that there should have been a state response. The trial court didn't believe it was necessary and denied the motion without the state having filed a response, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and you're saying that's one of the errors, and I was trying to figure out from your allegations in your habeas. I mean, I compared your habeas petition to the habeas petition in Coleman. Coleman says all different things that they thought were wrong that need to be brought back for review. Okay? Then tell me what it is if it's not a suppression motion. I don't know what you're really here for. What do you want to appeal?
The major difference here, Your Honor, is that Mr. Lopez-Quintero didn't have a direct appeal at all.
Fine. What do you want to appeal? What's your issue?
Well, what we're asking for in the state writ of habeas corpus was that counsel's ineffectiveness, trial counsel's ineffectiveness in failing to preserve the right to appeal deprived him of that intent.
To appeal what? You have to have some kind of an issue, or how is failing to appeal a failure? I mean, just compare your petition with Coleman's. And I looked at it, and Coleman's lists, chapter and verse, what they want to bring back before the courts. I thought maybe it was a suppression issue. Obviously, I'm wrong on that. I can't figure out what it is you want to do if we say, yeah, you get an appeal. What is the issue?
The issue is we want his appellate rights reinstated.
That's so not the issue that I'm asking you about. I'm saying if we agree with you and we give you the appellate rights that you're asking for, what issue are you going to bring before the courts?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor, because we don't know what the issue is. Mr. Lopez-Quintero never had a direct appeal, never had post-conviction.
Oh, you're not answering my question, counsel.
Maybe I'm not understanding it, but the difference
in Coleman...
I want to know
what's the issue you want to appeal. If I say, yep, everything you say is correct, by darn, you should have had an appeal, and counsel was ineffective for not filing the proper papers. Okay, what is the issue you want to bring within that appeal if I agree with your argument?
Your Honor, respectfully, we don't have to show any issue that we want to appeal. All that we need to show is that there is per se prejudicial being deprived of a critical judicial proceeding. That is it. All we need to show...
that's your argument.
All we need to show is that there's deficient performance.
Okay.
Counsel was deficient in not preserving the right to appeal.
Well, now, compare the petition that was filed here with the petition in Coleman. There are night and day differences.
Counsel, you assert you don't have to... show the underlying appellate issue, if there is one, or assert any at all. What's your authority for your response?
Well, I think the United States Supreme Court said that in Roe versus Flores-Ortega. This court has said it in Flores as well, I believe. And the difference with Coleman, of course, is we're not talking about certain issues that appellate counsel should have raised. He was not deprived of an entire judicial proceeding. And that's a much different situation than what we're facing here. The deprivation of an entire judicial proceeding, direct appeal and post-conviction, per se, that is per se prejudicial. All we have to prove in our habeas corpus proceeding is that counsel was deficient. And the historical record is undisputed on that.
In which is the case, there is, I know there, that is there, that it is per se ineffective assistance of counsel to have an attorney fail to bring a right to appeal as of right. Is that Flores?
That's Flores,
okay.
I believe. Yes, Your Honor. So the problem is we don't even have the transcripts in this case. Thousands of pages cost thousands of dollars. And when the...
He was granted a fee waiver, wasn't he?
Correct, Your Honor. We don't know what happened with those transcripts. One attorney is deceased. The other attorney doesn't have those transcripts. We copied some of the transcripts down at the Kenosha County Courthouse. We weren't allowed to scan them for free of charge. But one of the things to keep in mind is that counsel in the motion for new trial raised a number of issues in the motion for new trial. All these issues, which could have been raised on direct appeal to the Court of Appeals. Now, issues about improper jury instructions, issues about change of venue, issues about improper closing arguments by the prosecution. All of those issues could have been raised on direct appeal. Now, whether there are additional issues, I don't know. And I don't think Mr. Lopez-Quintero has to show this court that he's got some sort of winning issue. It's akin to a lawyer who's sleeping during a trial. We don't have to show a particular instance when the lawyer was asleep to determine whether or not the witness testifying had some material information to present to the jury.
Counsel, when the habeas petition was filed in this case, Coleman and Smalley had already been decided, and it seems to be clear that from their reading at least, there is a time element to a habeas petition, right?
Smalley came up to this court, I'm sorry, through Coleman. Everybody thought it was a laches case.
Right. And then we decided Smalley was confused. It conflated habeas and laches. But Coleman was laches, yeah?
Coleman was a laches decision.
Okay. So when the petition in this case was filed, everyone understood that there could be the possibility of a time bar on the petition, right?
The courts talked about Smalley and dicta, but yes, that decision was out there in Coleman.
Right. All right. So, So whether we do this as a prejudicial delay to the state or unreasonable delay as with respect to the petitioner, you knew that would be an issue, right? So Mr. Lopez-Quintero knew he'd have to be able to explain why the 9-year delay, yeah?
And we did that, Your Honor.
Okay, so you said he doesn't speak English. I get that. Here's what I'm concerned about. Page 5 of your brief. You say, on May 1, 2010, less than 2 years after the circuit court denied the motion for new trial, Mr. Lopez-Quintero submitted an application for assistance to the Frank J. Remington Center at the University of Wisconsin Law School, yes?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Why is there nothing about that in the record?
Well, we didn't put that in the record initially in the writ of habeas corpus. We believe we had presented enough information in that petition.
And you're willing to gamble the petition on just a reference to Mr. Lopez-Quintero not speaking English?
Well, the Court of Appeals actually did say that Mr. Lopez-Quintero's limitations could account for some of the delay, but not all of the delay, not 9 years of delay.
But why? And then, let me just add this. Same page of the brief, 2 years later, July 23, 2012. Mr. Lopez-Quintero submitted a second application to the Remington Center. And that's the one that eventually was accepted and pursuant to which the petition here was filed, yeah?
That's correct.
Okay, and there's a 5-year delay between when that request for assistance from the Remington Center was filed and when the petition was filed. But we don't know why the 5-year delay. There's nothing in the record about that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so all we have is that he doesn't speak English.
He doesn't speak English. He has a limited education, middle school education.
Is that
familiar? Excuse me?
I apologize. That is in the record. Yes, that's in the petition?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And certainly we believe that we have provided enough information. I think it raised an issue with the Court of Appeals, and I don't think the Court of Appeals should have determined as a matter of law, especially when they have that statement in their opinion saying it can account for some of the delay. Do we really want the courts of appeals or the circuit courts involved in the minutiae of determining through some abstract judicial calculus how much time is going to be accounted for by the inability to speak English and how much time is going to be accounted for by his middle school education or unfamiliarity with the legal system?
What exactly is the issue or issues before this court, and how do you want them decided?
Well,
so issue number one is?
Well, the issue is whether or not the Smalley procedure is permitted. Is the Court of Appeals decision?
That's not good enough. You have to tell me what the procedure is exactly that you're objecting to.
Well, the exact procedure we're objecting to is this prompt and speedy filing requirement for night petitioners that the Court of Appeals found in Smalley to exist in 809.51. And that prompt and speedy filing requirement is problematic. It's objectively wrong for three reasons. One, it doesn't comport with equity. It doesn't comport with the great writ of habeas corpus. Two, it treats the great writ as no different than a supervisory writ. And in fact, when this court enacted 809.51, it applied only to supervisory writs. It was never intended to vindicate a person's wrongful restraint on their liberty. It was intended to deal swiftly and quickly and deny most petitions seeking a supervisory writ.
But the wrongful retention of someone against their constitutional right involves an issue that caused them to be wrongfully retained, correct?
That's correct.
What is the issue in his trial, and this conviction occurred after, a 6-day trial, what is the issue that causes him to be wrongfully retained?
Is it fair to say, counsel, no one's been able to look at what the issue is because he was denied his per se right to an appeal?
That is exactly correct, Your Honor.
And then no one has been able to take that time to do that because he never got the right that he's entitled to, which is to appeal his case as of right. And that had his attorney done his job, that would have happened.
That's
correct. Sitting here today without that right and asking that he have his right to appeal.
Okay, I appreciate your help of counsel, Justice Dowd, but it doesn't resolve my concern that we don't grant writ of habeas corpus for something that may be totally frivolous without any merit underneath anything. It is a great writ, but it relies on equity. And equity has two parts, fairness to Mr. Lopez-Quinteros and fairness to the person that was involved in the unfortunate matters that caused his conviction. So it requires more than just saying, oh, I didn't get an appeal. I'm frustrated, obviously, by there's no statement either in your filings and to hear today about what is the issue that caused him to be unconstitutionally retained.
Can I ask this question that might, I don't know what the answer is.
Can we get an answer to the Chief Justice's question?
You can answer. I think this is been answered, but
yes, Your Honor, to put it as clearly as I can, Mr. Lopez-Quintero was denied the right to effective assistance of counsel, which deprived him of his right to post-conviction and right to direct appeal. Now, if he got that right, if this court were to give him that right back, he may eventually end up having an attorney who decides to file no appeal, and he agrees with it, or to file a no-merit brief, or he may have some compelling constitutional issues and direct appeal issues. We don't know. And he should not be burdened, and it's in fact cannot be burdened under the law when this is a per se violation of his right to effective assistance, that he's been denied an entire critical judicial proceeding.
Well, let's see how much weight that bears. So he absolutely has a right to appeal, but he can waive that right, right?
That's correct.
All right. So in the form that he was given after conviction, the notice of right to pursue post-conviction relief, he checked the box indicating that he wanted to. Yeah?
That's correct.
All right. But he could change his mind.
At that point, Your Honor, counsel has an explicit duty under statute and under this case's decisions to file the notice of intent to seek post-conviction relief. At that point itself, counsel is ineffective by
he
not
does.
Filing.
But the defendant might decide he doesn't want to pursue an appeal, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so whether there's a constitutional violation depends on whether he actually did want to pursue an appeal.
And he indicated that he did. There's no question about that, Your Honor.
Well, there's no indication that he wanted to at that point. But he can change his mind. Yeah?
There's no question he wanted. He did want to. He checked the box on the notice of right.
I understand that he wanted to at that point, but he could change his mind after that, right? That's yes or no.
He could.
He could,
Your Honor.
Good.
He didn't.
Now,
and
how do we know that?
What we know is the notice of intent was not filed 20 days later.
I know.
He indicated that.
I know, but how do we know he didn't change his mind?
Because the motion for new trial hearing, counsel said that I want to be appointed to determine whether to initiate an appeal on Mr. Lopez-Quintero's behalf. But the deadline had already passed 2 months earlier.
Is that part of the record?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Where do I find that?
That's in the...
Is that in the petition?
Yes, it's in the petition. We've incorporated as an exhibit portions of the motion for new trial hearing at which the court is engaged in a colloquy with counsel about getting appointed to initiate the appeal.
It's the transcript, it's not the motion.
The transcript, okay. I'm sorry, the transcript of the motion for new trial hearing.
Are you also asking us, though, putting aside the other piece of this, in terms of process, are you asking us to find that this element of timeliness is not a part of the of 80951, and therefore the state should be the one to bring, I know you don't necessarily agree latches apply, but should the state have an affirmative defense that process should have been, that the state responds, the state can assert latches if that's what they want to assert, and then at least you would have an opportunity to respond to that affirmative defense?
That's correct, Your Honor, because what happens is Smalley basically makes the Coleman decision obsolete, or it creates this two-tiered system. The first tier is one in which the state stays silent while the Court of Appeals reviews the petition, and maybe they're going to dismiss it summarily ex parte. But if it doesn't and orders the state to respond, now we bring up latches.
And you're saying this, so as far as what allows the court to do this ex parte, you're saying timeliness shouldn't be one of those things.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Other things might be, like frivolousness or some other thing that the state uses in terms of equity to dismiss, but not timeliness.
Not timeliness, that's right, Your Honor. It should never be dismissed on timeliness alone, based on principles of equity, based on the principles surrounding habeas.
But latches could be raised and you could respond to latches.
We would at least have an opportunity. And there, the record, I think, is clear. There's no prejudice to the state whatsoever. The historical record is undisputed.
Okay, thank you.
But we haven't even gotten there, right, because latches wasn't applied. And my question for you is, if we were to apply latches in this case and with respect to writs of habeas corpus, that would always require the state to respond, right?
If I may respond, I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes, the state would have an opportunity to respond and raise the defense of latches if it wished, to show an unreasonable delay, that it was unaware that we would be raising an ineffectiveness claim and that the delay prejudiced the state. And we would have an opportunity then, I think we should have that opportunity if the court goes that way, at an evidentiary hearing in the circuit court. But I would ask the court instead, let's get to the heart of the matter. Let's talk about ineffective assistance of counsel and the deprivation of an entire judicial proceeding. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Kara Mealy on behalf of the respondent, Michael Dittman. The rule in Wisconsin is that a petitioner seeking a writ of habeas corpus under 80951 must show a prompt and speedy request for relief. Where that does not occur, the Court of Appeals has discretion to dismiss the petition for unreasonable delay, regardless of whether that delay causes prejudice to the state.
Where's the prompt and speedy requirement come from?
The case law, Your Honor.
Okay, so it's not 80951.
Correct. It's the text of the statute itself does not say anything about what the Court of Appeals, the habeas court, should consider in deciding whether to issue the writ.
And which case are you citing to, other than Smalley, which was dealt with in Coleman? Is that the only...
Smalley is where the rule originated from, Your Honor.
Okay, other than Smalley, where else do we get prompt and speedy?
It's Smalley.
Okay.
In terms of the context of a habeas petition, right. As you know, in the supervisory writ context, that's already been established.
Right. And you would acknowledge that a supervisory writ and a writ of habeas corpus are two totally different types of writs.
They're different, Your Honor, but what I will say is they're both equitable actions where the court hearing the petition is a court in equity, and courts of equity have equitable powers to decide whether to issue the writ.
When the Court of Appeals made that assertion in Smalley, did they cite to any authority to support that premise, or did they engage in any analysis to support that premise?
To support the prompt and speedy filing requirement,
yes.
Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
The Court of Appeals in Smalley didn't specifically. It drew on habeas principles.
So the answer to my question is, you know, oftentimes when courts assert, and I can bring up the paragraph,
sure.
When the courts assert a statement of law, they oftentimes cite authority for that statement. And if they cite no authority because there is no existing authority, then they put forth analysis to support that statement. Did Smalley Court do either with regard to that assertion?
My belief is that they cited to 80951 sub 1 D, which says that the petitioner has to state the reasons why the court should exercise jurisdiction. So my understanding of what they did is they used their equitable authority to create this rule, and they linked it to 80951 sub D.
Which does not have in its text anything about being prompt.
Absolutely. Okay. Yep, we can see that.
So for the premise, the assertion that it has to be prompt, did they cite any authority for that that supports that assertion?
No, Your Honor, but they do discuss equitable principles in the opinion.
So why is Smalley not just categorically wrong for this statement? Smalley's petition does not allege facts demonstrating that he sought prompt and speedy relief. Such a showing is required. See Rule 809.51 sub 1. That's just wrong, right?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it's wrong, because the statute itself, 809.51, does not say anything about what the Court of Appeals is supposed to consider in deciding whether to issue the writ.
That's right. But when Smalley reaches out to that rule for the requirement that it be done promptly and speedily, they're just wrong in that.
I don't know that they're wrong because there's nothing in the statute that says these petitions can be brought at any time. I think.
So let's take this piecemeal. So we start with the Great Writ running hundreds of years back into the mists of the English meadows, and therein we find no statutes at all controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Correct.
So that comes down to us through the ages and through express incorporation, through our constitution, adopting the common law of England as it appeared at that time. And then there's an overlay of statutes that we start building on that, right? So the statutes can change what the statutes address. But if they don't address it, it doesn't mean anything, does it?
If the legislature doesn't address it?
Right.
Your Honor, if the legislature doesn't address it, then the habeas court can step in using its equitable authority
right. And
create a rule. That's what Launcher v. Thomas
there
does.
There you go. So when 809.51.1 says absolutely nothing about timing, then timing is just a matter of the exercise of our equity authority.
Correct.
It has nothing to do with the statutes.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So when Smalley reached out to the statute for justification for a prompt and speedy requirement, it was wrong in reaching for the statute for that principle.
I think you could put it that way. I think you could also just say it was citing to the statute, because the statute says you've got to give us reasons for why we should issue the writ. And I know that the reasons aren't listed in the statute, but I think they were just saying the legislature hasn't spoken on this issue, therefore we can exercise our authority. I think Holland, I discussed in my brief, is an example of a habeas court, a court of equity, using its equitable powers to shape the availability of the writ. This is not a new thing, a habeas court using its power to shape the availability of the writ. In Holland, they expanded the availability of the writ by saying equitable tolling applies to the one-year statute of limitations. In terms of creating limitations on the availability of habeas corpus, we see that in a lot of the federal procedural bars. Most of those limitations, most of those bars were created by courts before they were codified by Congress. So this idea that a habeas court can step in where the legislature hasn't spoken is nothing new. And I do believe that is what the Court of Appeals in Smalley did here. And the reason why they could do it is because the statute didn't interfere with their authority to do so. Had the statute said that these petitions can be brought at any time, I don't think we would be here. Because Launcher v. Thomas instructs that in that situation, the habeas court errs. If there is a specific rule governing the situation and a habeas court tries to exercise their general equitable powers in a different way, then there's an error.
All right. So if the prompt and speedy requirement does not come from statute and the timeliness factor comes from the latches defense, doesn't that have a significant impact on what the petitioner is required to show to obtain relief?
I'm not sure if I'm following
sure.
you.
Sure. So latches requires you establish one of the elements, the first one, that there was unreasonable delay
mm-hmm.
in seeking relief. Third element is prejudice to the state. Yeah. So prompt and speedy, if that's a thing, prompt and speedy puts a burden on the petitioner to show that he brought this promptly and speedily.
Correct.
Rather than having, in the latches context, the burden is on the state to show that they did not bring it promptly and speedily. Right?
That's correct.
So that seems to be a significant difference.
Sure. And I want to make clear that the latches and prompt and speedy are two different procedural gatekeeping requirements. Latches is an affirmative defense.
Yes.
Coleman discusses latches.
Yes.
But what Coleman says is Smalley is not a latches case. Yes, it used latches terminology.
Right, but if Smalley wasn't relying on latches principles, where did he get the timeliness requirement from?
I identify three equitable considerations that the Smalley court discussed that would justify a timeliness requirement on habeas petitions regardless of prejudice to the state in defending the action. First, it talked about focusing on a petitioner's conduct and determining whether they're entitled to equitable relief. That is a historical, equitable consideration, and it's discussed at length in the Law Review article I cited in my brief. Most of the procedural bars in the federal system all focus on the petitioner's conduct in deciding whether they're entitled to relief. They are essentially a direct response to the individual's blameworthy conduct. So when you look at latches, it's a little bit different because it's the state's burden to prove latches. So latches is not a direct response to the petitioner's blameworthy conduct and delaying bringing his petition because the state has to prove it.
Prior to Smalley, did we ever look at the petitioner's blameworthy conduct as a qualifying factor for a habeas petition?
I would say before Smalley, latches applied generally to habeas corpus. That was McMillan.
That's the burdens on the state.
Yeah, but you know, the first part is unreasonable delay in a latches analysis. So that I can see that focuses on the petitioner's conduct.
Mm-hmm.
However, latches also focuses on the state's conduct because the second element of latches is for the state to show that they had no knowledge that the petitioner was going to bring his claim.
Right. But with that unreasonableness aspect in the first element,
mm-hmm.
that's for the state to prove in the latches context. Smalley's pulling this out and saying some part of the timeliness thing is going to apply to the petitioner. Yes, you know, we do traditionally in the equitable context require clean hands. Yeah. But is that something that we can incorporate wholesale into the habeas context?
I think so, Your Honor. I think because there are good reasons for having a timeliness requirement on habeas petitions, regardless of prejudice, and those are finality and judicial efficiency. And I do believe that the Smalley Court did touch on those interests. In terms of finality, this Court states time and again that we need finality on our criminal cases. The United States Supreme Court talks about it and offers it as a justification for courts limiting the availability of the writ. And in terms of judicial efficiency, I think that's a really important point to talk about here today. We want these claims to be brought quickly. It benefits everybody involved. While witnesses are still around, I think it's worth noting that one of Mr. Lopez Quintero's trial attorneys has died in the over 9 years that he's waited to file his petition. While records still exist, there is a Supreme Court rule that allows court reporters to destroy their stenographer notes after 10 years. So in a situation where the defendant has not pursued a direct appeal, which is going to be a lot of these cases, there might not be hearing transcripts. There would be a transcript of the sentencing if the person went to prison because those are prepared. But that's a significant burden for the defendant. And I think the other point to consider is any type of collateral attack on a conviction, whenever a person's bringing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, they need to preserve the testimony of their trial attorney. And if their trial attorney is not alive, how are they going to succeed on their claim? So this rule of requiring these petitions to be brought quickly, it benefits everybody, not just the state in defending
the
action.
But doesn't that go to prejudice to the state as an element that the court would consider if we apply latches?
I think that it does certainly affect the state's ability to defend against the action, but what I'm saying is it also affects the defendant's ability to succeed on any kind of post-conviction claim.
Right, but my point in asking the question is you're focusing on prudential considerations and judicial efficiency. These are all things that the court could take into consideration in considering the state's proffer of a latches defense, but we don't even get to that here under the state's position, right? Because here the court applied a per se bar to this appeal simply based on untimeliness, unreasonable delay, as the court saw it, but the state didn't have to prove any prejudice whatsoever.
That's correct, Your Honor. We didn't have to prove prejudice, and the Smalley requirement doesn't require us to.
So if we were to apply latches here, is there any terrible burden on the state to establish prejudice?
In this particular case?
In any case.
I think that there is, and Your Honor, I think we're talking about practicality. Another important point to consider here is, to me, it just makes more sense to require the person with the knowledge of why it took as long as it did to bring the petition to be the person to address the timeliness of the petition. Because under Mr. Lopez Quintero's interpretation of the statute, the petitioner wouldn't have to put anything in his petition about why it took him as long as it did to bring the action. It would be incumbent on the state, if they were ordered to respond, to take a look at a petition. And we may say, well, this has been a 10-year delay, but there's no facts in here about what was happening. We may assert latches, But we don't know whether this was a reasonable delay, in which case the Court of Appeals would have to go back to the petitioner and ask the petitioner to explain why there was a delay, and then it would get sent back to the state once we had those facts to address latches.
If latches applies, do you contest that it is the state that has the burden to show prejudice?
I don't contest that, Your Honor.
I was going to ask, in terms of when we talk about blameworthy conduct, and I know you're talking about delaying bringing the petition, is that really what you're focusing
yes.
on? But isn't these facts of this particular case particularly concerning? Because when we talk about blameworthiness and what position the defendant is in, he's in a position of serving a lifetime sentence in prison, having never had that right of appeal that he is due, and it's been found to be per se ineffective assistance of counsel to not have gotten it.
Sure. And, Your Honor, I want to be clear about what was in the petition, and Justice Kelly touched on this a little bit. The facts about the Remington Center having this case for 5.5 years aren't in the petition. So the Court of Appeals didn't consider that. So what they considered was his stated limitations, which were his difficulty speaking English, his limited education. But what the petition says, if you really look at it, is for those reasons, he trusted that his trial attorneys would initiate his appeal, which is absolutely reasonable. Our clients expect their attorney to handle their appeals correctly. However, at some point in the 9 years, equity requires you to do more than just put your hands up in the air and say, I thought my trial attorney was going to do this for me. There's nothing in the petition about him trying to contact the court to see what was happening with his appeal. There's nothing in the petition about him reaching out to his trial attorneys, asking them what was going on with their appeal. All the state is asking for in these cases is for an explanation of why it took as long as it did to try to exercise your rights.
All right, and you're saying his explanation is not sufficient because he gave an explanation. This isn't a situation that you were referring to where someone just says, well, nothing, where they say nothing about why there was a delay.
Yes.
This is an explanation, but you're saying not sufficient in the state's
eyes. Correct. I do not believe it justifies 9.5 years for delaying the petition, and that is what the Court of Appeals determined as well. It's going to be difficult in these cases to give a number, right, of how long is too long. It's based on a reasonableness standard, and as this court knows, reasonableness standards are not amenable to hard and fast rules. I think it's fair to say the longer that the person waits to file their petition, the harder it's going to be to show a prompt and speedy request for relief, just because you're going to have that much more delay to account for. In a situation where it's a shorter period of delay, it's going to be easier to explain away. And the other point is that if it's a shorter amount of delay, this is a balancing. And I think the state's interest in finality and judicial efficiency are not going to be implicated as much in a smaller period of delay. But again, here we're at 10 years.
And you're saying as a balancing, then you would also potentially weigh what right we're talking about that's been infringed, potentially here where you've got a right that you never had that you have due to you as a matter of right versus had he communicated with his attorney or something about that right to appeal.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Here's the question. The question, in part, I am paraphrasing, the question that we took for review here. Can the Court of Appeals apply an irrebuttable presumption of prejudice and deny ex parte this petition? Do you agree that in denying the petition ex parte, the Court of Appeals applied an irrebuttable presumption of prejudice?
No, Your Honor. I think that is based on a misreading of the Smalley's decision. I think it is correct that in the last sentence of the opinion, they do talk about prejudice to the state. And as this court in Coleman recognized, they do talk about latches in a somewhat confusing way. I don't think the court even need to discuss latches to create the prompt and speedy filing requirement, because to me, based on my reading of that case, the primary justifications for the timeliness requirement are finality and judicial efficiency. So this repeated assertion that Smalley created a presumption of prejudice is based on a reading of Smalley as saying we're going to impose this timeliness requirement because we're going to presume that the state is delayed any time that there's a delay in filing a petition. And I think to say that that's what Smalley says means you've got to disregard the paragraphs before that last sentence.
Counsel, is there any difference between the prompt and speedy requirement in Smalley on the one hand, and on the other, the first element of latches?
Your Honor, I don't think so.
Okay.
And I have thought about that in terms of whether that means the state's not going to be arguing latches in these cases. I think practically speaking, because the burden is on the petitioner to address unreasonable delay, I think we likely won't be, because if they meet their burden to show that they timely filed it, I don't think we'll meet our first element of the test. I want to talk about the argument that this Smalley timeliness requirement violates due process in some way. In terms of there being a notice issue, the notice here is the rule of law articulated in Smalley and then clarified in Coleman. There are a lot of pleading requirements that exist in our case law that aren't in statutes. One that comes to mind is 974.06. Sometimes a defendant has to show that the post-conviction counsel claims that he wanted post-conviction counsel to raise are clearly stronger than the ones post-conviction counsel did raise. That comes from the case law. That's not in 974.06, but that doesn't mean there's a due process problem there. And in terms of the opportunity to be heard, that's the petition. 80951 does instruct the petitioner to explain the reasons why the court should take the case, and that, supplemented with Smalley and Coleman, gives the petitioner a chance to address the delay issue.
So how should the court write this opinion, in your opinion?
Yeah. Your Honor, I think that this case presents a great opportunity for the court to tie together the writ standard, much like the court has done with the supervisory writ standard, where Kalal lists the four factors that a petitioner must show. I'm not aware of a case that puts them all together yet. I would say the first three factors should be the traditional habeas corpus factors. Custody, you need to allege a constitutional jurisdictional issue, and then you also need to allege no adequate remedy at law. And then the fourth factor would be you need to show a prompt and speedy filing, request for relief. And I would also make clear in the opinion that if the Court of Appeals does order the state to respond, which they have discretion to do under the statute, that doesn't mean that the burden has shifted to the state to address the timeliness of the petition. It remains with the petitioner. I do want to touch on the amicus brief for a moment and the idea that Mr. Lopez-Quintero's delay should be imputed to the state. I first want to say that the cases that the amicus brief cites to, I believe, miss the mark. He relies on cases that show ineffective assistance of counsel that directly causes a procedural default. In this case, the alleged ineffective assistance of counsel did not directly cause the procedural default that we're talking about here today, because the procedural default that we're talking here today about is delay. And Mr. Lopez-Quintero has not alleged that his trial attorney in any way prevented him from filing this petition before 9.5 years.
Isn't that argument just a manipulation of the lens? That is, how wide you want the scope? Isn't the procedural default that we're dealing with here is that he didn't, that his counsel abandoned him and he had ineffective assistance of counsel? Depends on which focus in your lens you want to tighten up to.
Well,
and you say delay is the focus, and the other side might say, no, the procedural default is that his attorneys abandoned him and he couldn't exercise his Sixth Amendment right or his 14th Amendment right to due process.
Are you saying that their position would be that because his attorney didn't file the notice of intent, that created the default?
No, I'm saying that your argument is manipulable based on what you want to focus on. And that's valid, but I'm saying there are other areas of focus also that would undercut your argument.
Okay, yeah, sure. The point I'm trying to make is that the cases that are in the amicus brief are distinguishable because there is a direct connection between the ineffective assistance of counsel and the procedural bar at issue. In both of the cases, the trial attorneys in state court did not raise state court claims, and that's why they were barred in federal court. And again, this case is distinguishable because he has not alleged, I didn't file this petition before 9 years because my trial attorney told me it was going to take that long. He did not allege, I consistently contacted my trial attorney during that 9 years, and my trial attorney told me he was working on my case. So it is a distinguishable situation. The other thing that I would point out is, to the extent that the amicus brief is suggesting that the delay in this case, Mr. Lopez-Quintero's delay, should be imputed on the state, I think it's worth pointing out that Wisconsin has robust procedures in place for ensuring that a defendant understands that he has a right to appeal his conviction and that he has the right to assistance of counsel on appeal. At sentencing, the circuit court is required to tell that to the defendant. At sentencing, the trial attorney is required to go through the notice of right form with his client. At sentencing, the defendant is required to sign that form saying that he understands he has a right to appeal and he has the right to assistance of counsel on appeal. And at sentencing, the defendant he walks out of court with that piece of paper which says he has a right to appeal and he has the right to assistance of counsel on appeal. And so Wisconsin does have a lot of procedures in place for guaranteeing people's right to appeal. There are no further questions. Thank you.
I just want to touch briefly on the facts in the Coleman case where the Court of Appeals and this Court found as a matter of law that Coleman's delay was unreasonable. Coleman didn't assert that he tried to seek pro bono counsel or free legal assistance. He had a copy of his transcript. He wasn't laboring under any language disabilities. And he said that his only disability was not having the funds to hire an attorney to review his case. Now, Mr. Lopez Quintero had a number of disabilities that he brought up.
You listed those in the petition. So let's assume for the sake of this argument that the court disagrees with you, that those were acceptable reasons for 9.5 years of delay. Is it your position that petitioners can engage in unreasonable delay before they bring their petitions?
No, I think the courts always have an opportunity to control their dockets if they believe petitioners aren't being diligent or involved in some sort of gamesmanship.
Okay, my understanding of your argument here was you objected to the prompt and speedy requirement imposed by Smalley. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. But you've agreed now that petitioners cannot engage in unreasonable delay before they bring their petitions, correct?
Well, I'm talking about gamesmanship, some sort of something that's beyond delay, something that is beyond untimeliness.
Are you suggesting a requirement of showing of bad faith?
Something like that, but I think the more important point is that the court should get to the merits and talk about the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right, but we do have a gateway function to perform in determining whether the petitioner is unreasonably delayed, right?
I think the unreasonable delay should never apply when a petitioner raises a non-frivolous night petition that he has been
But we deal with the frivolousness in the statutory requirements of what you have to show in the habeas petition. So the question is, let's say you satisfy what the statute says you have to have in your petition. The question is, can the court ask whether the petitioner has engaged in unreasonable delay in bringing the petition?
I think that should be an affirmative defense that the state raises.
So on the face of it, the court cannot ex parte deny a petition for unreasonable delay. So the court must accept on the face that any amount of delay cannot have any effect on whether or not they have to require the state to respond to a petition.
That's correct. And the common law allowed petitioners to bring cases even after 44 years. Now, the courts were not defenseless, and the state was not defenseless even without the latches defense at that time, because the courts took into account the petitioner's delay in weighing the credibility of the evidence and the witnesses, and any sort of delay then is imputed on the petitioner's burden to prove the merits of the underlying claim.
So the courts get a lot of habeas petitions, and why is it that the courts would have to accept unreasonable delay as it considers whether to deny a petition ex parte?
Because of the nature of the writ of habeas corpus and its tie to equity, Your Honor, that equity has always been a part of the determination by the common law courts about governing habeas corpus mm-hmm. procedures.
And clean hands have always been a part of equity as well, yes?
That's correct, Your Honor. But clean hands never involved the complete dismissal of the habeas petition. The courts always reach the merits. Always reach the merits in the common law.
As I understand it, your argument is that the proper procedural mechanism for an untimely filed writ, I'm not saying unreasonably timely filed, but untimely filed writ of habeas corpus is to apply the doctrine of laches. Am I right or wrong?
Our position, Your Honor, is that the court shouldn't be making that untimeliness decision. The court, if the petition is not frivolous and the petition is raising a claim of ineffective assistance that the petitioner has been deprived of an entire judicial proceeding, then the court should hear the merits of that claim and take into account the delay based on missing witnesses, lost or destroyed records, deceased witnesses. That's what the court should do, and that's how the court can take into account delay, that judges can resolve doubts against the petitioner who has delay.
And where does the Where does the state raising laches fit into your argument then?
Well, at the very least, Your Honor, Mr. Lopez Quintero was in a much better, stronger position than Mr. Coleman, and he should have at least had the opportunity to respond to the state's invoking of laches. He never had that opportunity.
Very good.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.